A little sound on this. A couple of announcements before I get started with the talk. There's a missing phone. If any of you might have seen a phone, I believe it's a Samsung, and it has a cracked screen and it doesn't have a case. If you happen to come across it, if you could drop it off at the office, that would be great. And also, it would be so helpful if there was no food or liquid or drinks in the hall. It really helps keep everybody safe and takes care of these beautiful floors that we have that's holding us. So please attend to that as well. So maybe you know this little tune. It goes like this. Here's the little song I wrote. You might want it to sing it note to note. Don't worry. Be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when we worry, you make it double. Don't worry. Be happy, be happy, be happy. So I want to talk a little bit about restlessness and worry tonight and give you some tools to work with, that kind of common challenge that we face when we get ourselves still. But I want to provide a little bit of the matrix of what we're doing in this practice. Yeah, I've been so struck with the fact that half of the people here are under 40. You know, this is very different than when I started practicing. And half the people here are maybe even more than half. This is their first retreat, and also new to this community, Insight Meditation Society. Not to mention we're colored folks, you know, all together in this space. So it's quite a big deal when you think about what we're doing here, what we're undertaking, and it's new for a number of people. So when I say I want to provide a matrix, I just want to remind us, or to share maybe to some of you for the first time, that we're in a sacred system of practice with the Dharma. This practice has these teachings have been around for over 2,600 years. So the path has been well walked in terms of these liberative teachings. And upon the Buddha's enlightenment, the Buddha offered this kind of eloquent template of the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering just being in this body. There's a cause of suffering, which is clinging, clinging. We can be free from suffering by letting go. And by the way, there's a way to do it. There's a path. There's an Eightfold Path that can be followed. So this is the kind of infrastructure of this beautiful sacred geometry that we're a part of participating in. And the core practice within the Eightfold Path, one of many, is mindfulness. And within mindfulness, there are four foundations. And Joanna's been speaking beautifully about that first foundation of the body and the breath. We attend to the body and the breath. You can think of these as kind of ways that lead us into more and more awareness. So the first foundation is the body and the breath. The second is dealing with feeling tones. this kind of way of looking where we're just noting experience very simply as pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. A lot of ways to work with just that simple but profound practice. Then the third foundation is thoughts, and looking at the quality of our thoughts, whether they're wholesome or unwholesome. And the fourth foundation has to do with dhammas, the five systems or strategies that support us in understanding how we perceive and make sense out of our experience through a dharmic lens. Right? So what I want to talk about tonight is within that fourth foundation. Within that fourth foundation of mindfulness, there's five systems in there that support us in looking at how we show up with our mind and our relationship with the mind activity. And one of those systems is referred to as the hindrances, the five hindrances. And the one I want to speak to more pointedly is restlessness and worry. It's one of the five. But I'll briefly just kind of highlight what these fives are like. But here's why this is important in a sense. We live in this kind of cyclone of complexity in our experiences. I like the way Toni Morrison attempts to talk about it. Toni Morrison, our ancestor, our beloved literary genius. She says that, how do we make sense out of a world that has corruption and innocence, purity and savagery, wisdom and irrationality, benevolence and wickedness, threat of outsiders and who we consider neighbors, distance and intimacy, receptivity and force? Now, we're all navigating these kind of tumultuous realities in our lives, whether they're big or small or however they might be showing up moment to moment. But this is the terrain, the territory, and complexity of our lives that we're walking in and trying to find, how do I find some peace, especially in this current political environment. It's just a lot going on in the world right now and in our own hearts. But we're all trying to figure out how to quench a thirst, a hunger, a longing, a yearning inside of ourselves as we navigate this terrain. And it's easy to feel like it's not going to happen, or that, you know, with our best efforts, it's pretty tumultuous. So we've tried different things. We try different jobs, different approaches, different relationships, different countries, different everything. And the very thing we're searching for out there is not to be found, because it has to do greatly, if not profoundly, are more pointedly with how we are in relationship with our mind. So we seek this satisfaction externally. The challenge is getting that this is a piece of work, a big piece of work that requires us turning internally. Now, the Buddha would talk about Toni Morrison's this and this in this way. He talks about the eight worldly winds. And he says, what contributes to suffering, the first noble truth, is that we have a desire for comfort and an aversion to discomfort. We have a desire for gain and an aversion to loss. We have a desire to pray for praise and an aversion to criticism. We have a desire for fame and an aversion to shame. So it's this relationship with, I want this, but I want this to go away. These ideas that this is good and this shouldn't be happening. is a big part of what contributes to suffering. Now, of course, my list of things that shouldn't be happening is okay, but I'm really talking about your list that, you know, I want you to be taken care of here. So it's our attachment to one over the other that contributes to the suffering or to the distress. And it could be subtle or it can be large. And these extremes represent, on one extreme, gratification. We want the gratification. And on the other extreme, danger. And the Buddha talks about how these two extremes really do represent a certain kind of distress. It all equates to suffering. And that there's a middle path to this that we want to entertain that provides a certain relief or escape from the extreme jostling that happens in our heart and mind because we have these preferences and we have assumptions about what should be showing up in our life and what shouldn't. So this is what I want to talk about a little bit this evening. Because while we're here in retreat, and while we get ourselves a little more settled, and the more we get ourselves settled, the more we get to see the activity of the mind, the way it's doing this dance of preferences. I want six of these, but only two of those, and that should be annihilated. And, you know, this is the stuff we're doing with our likes and dislikes. One of our teachers, Seodel Utai Janisha, says this, and this is a really quote that I read a lot. He says, one thing you need to remember and understand is that if you do not watch your mind, defilements will grow and multiply like weeds. So, but this is the real punchline. He says, the mind does not belong to you, but you are responsible for it. So we're playing with that. You know, how do I use this system of looking at my mind, looking at these hindrances as a way of taking responsibility for the habits of mind, the habituation of mind, which we can readily see when we get still, when we're not at battle for it, when we don't have preferences for what arises, right? We get to really tune into how this is playing in our lives and how powerful the habit of mind can be. So restlessness and worry is in that fourth foundation, is part of the hindrances. And here's some things I ran across that I've heard from wise people that I don't remember their names, so just overlook me. Left to its own devices, the mind tends to interfere with its own satisfaction. So that's a good line that I like to keep in mind. 99% of our thoughts are rehashed, and 80% of the 99% is negative, right? So we have that going on. And then there's Mark Twain that said, I've suffered a great many catastrophes in my life, but most of them never happened. So this is how the mind, the restlessness and worry could really play and have us in a spin of distraction from presence and clarity of this moment, of living in this moment. So these five hindrances, the first one that's listed is desire. It's our desire for sensual pleasure. So, oh, I want this. Oh, that tastes good. I want more of this. And oh, this is good. And I want the perfect sit. I want the perfect setup. I want. So the mind that races with that idea of wanting, desire. The second is aversion, our drive to push away hatred and ill will, things it's our mind being full of ill will and hatred and wanting to push things away is what aversion is about, these subtle ways that we're at war with ourselves and our mind. There's sloth and torpor, our inability to kind of rise fully to a challenge. This can be a mental fatigue and a physical fatigue that just keeps us in a state of collapse that makes it difficult to rise fully. There's doubt where we're uncertain. We feel insecure about, you know, maybe trusting or believing or letting ourselves go because, you know, there's all kind of ways we've been burnt. So we're suspicious and we're just not sure. And we question things. We question the teachings. We question our own good mind. And there could also be a quality of despair in the doubting. And there's restlessness and worry, which is the whirlwind of the mind. It's this sense of searching and agitation and a sense of ill at ease that happens, that we get in touch with when we sit. A sense of overwhelm, fear, agitation. There could be fantasy, exhaustion, and ambivalence that's playing here. We get tired in a cycle of judging, comparing, perfecting, fixing, yearning. We worry about the world, we worry about our work, we worry about our lives, we worry about ourselves. So there's this angst wrapped around restlessness and worry. And it's in my body, it feels like fear run amok. And so there's a sense of rumble that's inside the body. And there's this sense that if I just could figure it out in my head, if I could just, if I just worked at it a little harder, I'd get it, and then it would be, then I'd get it, and then, you know. And then there could be this element of just being bored with your thoughts. You know, I'm so tired of what I'm thinking, but I can't stop thinking about it. So there's this sense of, you know, it's not an easy thing to deal with. And then we have our frequent flyers around these hindrances. We have the ones that just show up every time, you know, or they show up regularly. And they show up because, of course, they want to be seen. Like, we're not making ourselves have these hindrances. The mind does this on its own. Where the suffering comes in is when we attach ourselves and start to engage the content in our mind. Then we're just had, you know. So it's the mind's job is to be busy 24/7. That's its job. It's an organ. It's a part of the body. The eyes see, the mouth tastes, the ears hear, the nose smells. The body feels, and the mind thinks. So the job of the mind is to be busy. So we're not trying to stop that. What we're trying to do is look at how we identify with what arises in the mind so solidly that it's hard to see all the other things that are present. And sometimes when we get so locked into this, it's referred to as a hindrance attack. We have a hindrance attack in our mind where we're just flooded with whatever the hindrance is. And sometimes this happens. So again, we're not making ourselves think. It's our relationship to thinking that we're really looking at. So the mind doesn't belong to us in that sense because we're not making it think. But we're responsible for it because of how we are in relationship to it, how we are in relationship to our thoughts. So we can't control what arises. I've said that. But we also don't want to just habitually or blindly just keep running on the trail with the hindrances. All hindrances, all five of these hindrances, hinder the mind from realizing clarity and peace. And the tricky thing about restlessness and worry, which I know a number of you are working with and kind of navigating, is that this is the hindrance of the five that tends to wrap itself around the other hindrances, right? So there's a little quality of that kind of morphs things up, like restlessness and worry. When it kind of solidifies itself around desire, it can feel like speed without a destination, right? Inside the heart and mind, there's a sense of weariness and manifestation of clinging and holding on for dear life, certain quality of desperation that's felt inside the heart and mind when restlessness and worry kind of congeals around desire. When restlessness and worry congeals around aversion, there could really be some real serious, I think this is what some wars are made of, you know, battle, revenge, and comparing aversion towards uncertainty, right? Not knowing. It's like having your foot heavily on the gas pedal while also on the brake, is the sense that I felt inside of myself. When restlessness and worry wraps itself around sloth and torpor, we can feel a real intense mental fatigue and physical exhaustion, a sense of dizziness or being off balance. It's like that ride at the amusement park where you spin it around and you're up against the wall and the floor drops out. They probably have more advanced ones now, but everything's virtual now, so you could actually die and be born again in the course of it. But when I was growing up, you went to the amusement park and you got in this big round thing and it sped you around until you were crazy and stuck to the wall. And then the floor dropped out while you're still spinning. And that was supposed to be fun. So that's what it can be like when you're wrapped around. It's just crazy when you think of, I can't believe I even did that ride. I did it a few times. Coming off all dizzy and falling down. Everybody's laughing. It's like, wow. After a while, it was like, that's really sick, isn't it? And then, you know, there is this kind of diffused or kind of discursive thinking that we have. It's not really charged, but it's just perpetual. It's like the elevator music in our minds all the time, just kind of this kind of insidious buzz, or you know, it's kind of a mild irritant, but it's not a real disturbance, but it's constant. And then when restlessness and worry wraps itself around doubt, we could be saturated in a sense of despair, and we worry about our restlessness. So there's that vicious cycle of doubting our restlessness and worrying about it and wondering if this is going to ever end. And the image I have for that is being in one of these New England roundabouts where you just keep going around and around in it and you wonder, which one of these roads do I go off? And you can never know. So you keep going around it. So that's kind of what the power of restlessness and worry. And, you know, those of us are out in the world really dealing with the insanity of pointing challenges out in some of the ways that we do, this hindrance in particular can really be heightened, not only in our day-to-day walk, but especially when we slow down, we get to see how we've been in relationship with our lives in this very powerful practice. So the activity of the restless mind, you could say that the restless mind, the job of it, is to guard the loss of the self, or the loss of the ego. So there's a purpose that is kind of playing with this kind of proliferation, if you will. It attempts to gain control through the false refuge of selfing. So we're actually manufacturing a self in the process of this kind of perpetual spin of, especially when we attach to it and over-identify with it, and we're off and running, we're engaged with it. There can be this sense of, especially with restlessness and worry, a hypersensitivity to what we're thinking, and at the same time, a hyper-attachment to it. So this combination of being sensitive to what we're thinking, but also unable to let it go. So here's a funny thing I heard. It says, my doctor asked if members of my family suffered from insanity. I replied, no, we all seem to enjoy it. So that's kind of what it's like. And I came across this line that says, I'm overwhelmed by my own intelligence. It's another way it can play. And then a pretty well-known psychoanalyst says, we are poor indeed if we are only sane. So this is our social kind of atmosphere that encourages a sense of that high energetic, our nervous systems are almost wired for it. So we maintain a sense of self by replicating or recycling ourselves through our hopes and our wants and our desires and our aversion again. And there is a middle path. So one of the ways that the Buddha or the teachings talk about this cycle is this word papancha. It's a Pali word, papancha. And the pa means one, and pancha means five. And I've also heard it referred to as a diversity of thought. It's a different spin on diversity, isn't it? Kind of a diversity of thought. It's kind of this proliferation, elaboration, adornment of the thinking. It's a selfing process that keeps us solidified to some notion of what we think is right and wrong. So one image I have that helps with this is like I'm back at the amusement park, okay? So you line up to get this cotton candy. You've been in a long line to get this cotton candy. There's a white long tube, you know, that they present, and then they wrap it around all this pink stuff, right? And then they hand it to you. And it's all sticky and full of sugar and all these things you probably shouldn't eat. But papancha is like the white stick that it's on is kind of the thought that arises. But what we do is we add all this pink stuff to it in our minds because we start to engage it. And it's like, oh yeah, this and that, oh, you know. It's like, I got to go get some of that. I want more of that. And then we end up with a hot pink mess in our hands. And another way to think about it is like there's the bare bone mind of, like the thought arises, let's call that a mannequin, right? And then we add to it by dressing the mannequin with all the clothes and the jewelry and all of that. Before we know it, there's a whole outfit of identity as opposed to just the bare experience of the mannequin, just the thought itself. So that's a practice of how do we not layer it on, add the pink stuff, add all the sugar to our experience, to the nature of the mind is that it's going to be thinking, but how do we not expand the whole identity out of it when that's happening? And that's one of the things that we can begin to look at. So selfing serves to solidify something, anything, everything, so that we can feel certain and reassured. But it doesn't have any kind of lasting quality to it. And it doesn't work. And then we feel defeated. And then we go back into more papancha at that point. And when this cycle of papancha, or this morphing, this costuming of thought that we habitually do in our minds, if that's not interrupted, then the spiral just kind of continues, and, you know, and we get ill, and just a whole lot of things can happen to us at that point. And what's happening in that morphing process is the experience of grasping. We're trying to get something. We're trying to work something. There's an imbalance and an over-efforting that is occurring. And the word for that is dukkha. It's a process of suffering. In her book, Listening to the Heart, Tanisara, a beloved teacher in our tradition, describes papancha this way. She says, it's when concepts and thoughts are entertained without wisdom. So our challenge is to interrupt this habitual dukkha-producing activity of mind. And it's just a mechanism, it's just a habit that we could actually see and begin to discern clearly and have a different relationship to it. So I'd like to offer a few strategies here to work with this. One is when you discover that you're caught by the hindrance, notice the moment you become aware of it, and just right there, take a breath. Right there, take a breath. And what you can do in that breath is you can explore the contrast of then and now. Because there is a different experience in the body and in the heart and in the mind when you're caught than it is when you notice that you're caught. And that's a real powerful thing to know. And also that shift represents being fixated in it to then observing what's happening. And just finding yourself to be curious about, thinking, caught, restlessness, doubt. And then feel what it's like to have seen that and now to be in the place that you're in. Notice the contrast, because in time it becomes a preference of feeling into the place more of recognition as opposed to fixation. And you can do that again and again. That can be a type of practice. Another way to work with this is if the restlessness and worry is persistent, and you feel steady enough inside yourself, you can investigate or lean into it with a bit more curiosity. Like, what is this? And here is where the noting practice can be really powerful. You can note what's happening. Give it a word. Sadness. Fear, right? So you note what's happening, and then you open to how that's experienced in the body. All of our thoughts have roots in the body. So we can always shift from a thought to looking at what are the deeper roots that will help me be with the sensation that the body is having. And we got some really good instruction on how to be with the body, the first foundation offering, looking at how that experience is from the sense of the elements, looking at it from the sense of the breath and the body and the bones. And so these are really useful explorations to see. What's happening in my body that is telling me that fear is present? And just being curious about that. So this noting practice is like a tracking practice. What's happening now? What's happening now? And what is the thought that I'm having? And what is the thought, what sensations are the thoughts rooted in this moment? And I think what we begin to readily see that we can rely on and maybe in time rest in is the impermanence of our thoughts. That they all kind of appear, they do their thing, and then they disappear. If we're not papancha, if we're not attaching ourselves and dressing the mannequin, right? The nature of our thoughts is, and everything else is that it arises and passes away. We could trust that. So we're not trying to make restlessness and worry go away. If we could do that, we probably would have done that already. Again, it's the nature of the mind to be busy. But we want to relate to it differently. We want to shift our responsibility to the activity of mind so we're not habituated and worn to a place of being worn down. In the teachings, this is a third strategy just to keep in mind, as the teaching instructs us to notice these hindrances in five distinct ways. It asks us to notice when they are there, notice when they go away, when they're no longer there, notice when they are returning, or when they're about to arise. Notice when you lose interest in them. And notice when the loss of interest is sustained. Right? Now these last two, when you lose interest and when the loss of interest is sustained, is what makes the practice more transformative as opposed to observable. Because up to that point, we're observing what's happening. But with these last two, we're actually in more of a transformation process of shifting our relationship to how we engage it. Now, in order to do that, what this means is that we need to understand the experiences we're having from a broader lens. So the habit of mind is that we're fixated on the hindrance. But there's a way that we can expand the view, zoom out of the view. And this is a mindfulness approach of seeing before, during, and after the hindrance. It's like the hindrance is not the only thing that's going on, but it's where we get in lockdown mode. And the practice is seeing if we could zoom out enough to see a broader play of mind. So this means becoming acquainted with before, during, and after the hindrance. And usually what happens before we get the hindrance attack or before we find ourselves snagged and caught by the hindrance is there's things to become aware of before that happens and after that happens and even during that, while that's happening. Sometimes that experience before and after it happens is kind of fuzzy and unfocused. And this is why we kind of ignore it, because it doesn't have a big charge to it. You know, it's like, you don't get my interest, you know. So we fast forward through these kind of in-between places that are also a part of oftentimes where we can find some spaces of relief and rest and emptiness. So one of our teachers, Bhante Gunaratara, Sri Lankan Theravada Buddhist monk, in his book Mindfulness in Plain English, he describes it this way. I thought this was a good way to bring it in to what we're talking about here. He says, awareness happens just before you start thinking. A flashing split second just before you focus your eyes and your mind on the thing. Just before you objectify it, clamp down on it mentally and segregate it from the rest of existence. Just before your mind says, oh, it's a dog, or it's a problem, or it's a hindrance. Those few seconds just before you conceptualize it as a thing is also mindfulness. This soft, unfocused awareness contains a very deep knowing that is lost as soon as you focus or fixate your mind and objectify the object into a concept. Once the mind fixates, mindfulness is quickly passed over. So I think the opportunity with this teaching is that mindfulness practice, this practice we're doing this week, this invitation we have through this system of sacred geometry, this fabulous, exquisite template of these teachings, is that mindfulness, that one of those paths in the Eightfold Path, the practice of mindfulness, is teaching us how to prolong our view of awareness so that we're not just fixed on the object of our agitation or the object of our desire. That's what we're trying to do. Just keep the lens wider open and see the full of experience and not just what we like or don't like. So the hindrances can't survive the bright light of awareness. You know, we're kind of interrupting the flow of things when we bring awareness to the mix. And mindfulness has a way of putting a frame around the overwhelm of restlessness and worry. And it supports a ripening of awareness and insight as we continue to do this practice. And as mindfulness grows, our mental capacity gradually shifts from the object of our fixation to the process of being aware. That's really what we're after, to understand the awareness process. Here's another strategy that I refer to as don't pick it up. Ajahn Chah, one of our teachers, beloved teachers in the Thai forest tradition, tells this story that he brought very large boundary markers, stones, into his monastery. And he asked one of his monks, is that stone heavy? And the monk says, oh yes, clearly, very, very heavy. And Ajahn said, not if you don't pick it up. So that's another way of being with the hindrances. There's a way, if the hindrances continue to be intense in our practice and you're just fatigued from the habit of mind, there are times when you just don't want to pick it up. You don't want to pick it up. You can say, no, not at this time, and return back to your anchor. It's kind of like what Joanna's t-shirt said last night. I'm not booked or busy, but I'm just not coming, right? We can say that to the hindrances of mind and then anchor ourselves in a one-pointed anchor and stay there. Joanna said something else when we were in the teacher's room that I think is befitting. Here, somebody gave us a bag of chocolates, and it was in all this blue and gold and glitter. And I opened the bag, and it's all spread out on the table. And Joanna says, oh, wow, this is yummy. But my body just doesn't want chocolate right now. It's like, yeah, we get to choose whether we are going to be in the habit of suffering or not, because that's our responsibility. That we can do. We can't stop the mind from thinking, but we can shift how we're in relationships. So don't pick it up requires that we are in a practice of aiming and sustaining our attention to our anchor, to the body and the breath, to the walking, to whatever that might be. So we're coming back when we say no, not having it, no, not going there right now, not with aversion, with deep care, just not having it, I'm putting my attention right here. And you want to hang out there and stay there to the degree that you can. Now, walking meditation is also a very powerful strategy or practice for restlessness and worry. And walking in a particular way, there's many ways to do this, but this is what I've found helpful in my practice. The focus of your attention on the bottom of your feet can be very powerful because it's like the furthest thing from your head that's so heavy with the thoughts, you know. So you're automatically shifting your attention just by choosing your anchor to say, to be the bottom of your feet. Now, when I'm walking, what I try to do when I'm walking is make contact with the floor in four points. The heel, the ball of my foot, the big toe, and the baby toe. So when I'm placing my feet down, I'm connecting with that kind of stability and focus. There's also teaching that I find helpful where when you're walking, you're focused on the bottom of your feet and even from the knees below is where I go. And I'm aware of lifting, swinging, and placing my feet. Lifting, swinging, and placing my feet. And each time I place my feet, I'm feeling those four points. So this is a kind of elaborate attending to the walking, but it brings the kind of focus one needs when the mind is highly activated with restlessness and worry. That your attention is down there, connected with the earth, a bigger body that can hold some of the, and ground some of the activity of mind. And you're not using a rigid body to do this, because rigidity is not strength. It doesn't help. You're bringing a lot of kindness to the practice. You're slowing it down and walking in this deliberate, intentional way. It's a anchor that supports us. And adding metta to that practice is very helpful as well. May I be at ease. I touch the earth. The earth touches me. I touch the earth. Yes. So bringing a sense of mantra to the practice is, again, a nice way to shift from the activity of mind that we're kind of caught in to being with something that's more grounded. And we do all of this with kindness, of course. We don't want to do anything in the practice that's harsh or punishing to ourselves in any way. It's hard to be mindful if that kind of rigidity and angst or harshness is brought to the practice. So we want to try to keep the metta flowing through our veins, through our heart. Again, it's atmospheric. It's the atmosphere in which we're doing our practice on some levels. And I think that one of the things that we could be reassured of to some degree, and that the teachings suggest and offer, and I've had moments myself, many moments, is to not be hindered, to not be caught, to find yourself in these moments where you are not hindered in your mind. You're not caught by something. You're more in a place of calm and ease. Now what happens, the teachings tell us that what happens when we're not hindered is that there is a flood of delight and joy that can come into our experiences, especially if that hindrance, not being hindered, is sustained. we open to these experiences of intense joy. And there was a number of metaphors in the teaching for the hindrances that describe, you know, this is what it's like. It's kind of, this is what it's viscerally like if the hindrance is not operating. And so for restlessness and worry, when the hindrances are have subsided, and they do, it can feel and sustained. It can feel like you're free, you've been freed from bondage. The teachings say that when desire is no longer gripping you, the feeling is like you're free from debt. You just have no debt in your life. To be free from aversion, to be relieved from the grip that it represents, is like feeling healthy after a long illness. And to be released from sloth and torpor for a period of time is to feel like you're released from prison. And the relief that we feel when doubt is not our occupation is that we feel safe after a dangerous trip across the desert without food or water. Just to give you a taste of just what it's like. We know what the hindrances are like, but to be in a state where we have relieved ourselves of it. And there are moments when you will experience that, or you probably have already in this week. There are moments when we can notice that we are feeling quite blissful and peaceful. And the invitation is to open to that, to not allow the fixation of mind to rob you of the good feelings that can also be available to you. Now, you can't make this kind of feeling of delight and everything. You can't force that to happen. You can't make it happen. That would just be another form of grasping or preference. You open to this happening by suspending your habit of over-identification with the hindrances when they arise. And the realization of feeling a sense of delight sometimes happens in retrospect. Like when you are in a feeling of bliss, you're not trying to then think about, okay, so how is this feeling and where, you know. Sometimes you just want to allow it to be fully present in your body. Just allow it to flood through. And it's in retrospect then that you can examine what that was and what were the conditions that supported it. And Ayakima, also an ancestor in our tradition, she offers these instructions of when you touch into delight. If you find when you're sitting that you have these moments that you've just been really enjoying, what she suggests is before you open your eyes at the close of the sit, take a few moments to do three things. And to do these things without effort. Number one is recapitulate or recap what happened that got you here. So you can reflect back on the sit, for example. You know, what was your attitude when you came to sit? And how was your posture? And what was your intention? Did you set an intention for that sit? And you want to just recap, wow, you know, this was a beautiful sit. You know, what are gently, not in a harsh academic way or charged way, but, you know, what were the conditions? How did this come together? This is beautiful. The second thing she says is acknowledge impermanence. acknowledge to yourself that while you had a blissful moment, just like you have hindrances, they're not going to last forever. So acknowledge impermanence. Honor that this was then and it's not now. All experiences will end. The good, the bad, and the ugly. All of them will end. They will arise and pass away. And the third thing she says is, what am I learning? What are the insights that I'm learning from this practice? To always be curious about that. Honor that there is something inside that I have that I can't find outside of myself. And I'm experiencing the goodness of that right now. So these are a few strategies to keep in mind. The mind is a dynamic process, and when the mind is stuck on what has arisen, it is rigid and limited. And delight comes from a release from the fixation. And the release comes, it's a shift that is fundamentally a game changer when you really begin to practice and see your capacity to kind of release your mind just by the way you're in relationship to what's habitually happening. I worked with a client who shared this insight after working with restlessness and worry wrapped around aversion. And she said, through practice I've come to realize that the family story feels important, but it's old. Not so much in the foreground, but rather background. Traces, shapes, and shades. No longer deep grooves. I feel lighthearted, spacious, freed up. I even think I can be around them now. Right? It's not a dependence on whether the external environment changes. It's your ripening of your own understanding that supports you showing up in places without being knocked off center. And so our practice is to realize these insights, not fix, gain, or achieve a result, right? But it's the realization of these insights. Because our happiness doesn't depend on whether the world ever gets it right. It can't. Don't wait for that. Your happiness is much more readily accessible. It's in your mind. It's your relationship with how you're working with the causes and conditions that arise in our heart and mind. So let's take a couple of minutes to just sit together. So here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry. Be happy. Thank you for your attention, and enjoy your walking period. We'll meet back shortly.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.